Hello and welcome to Password with Peter Warren, Castle Radio's technology programme, done on a weekly basis and has been for a while. We have an issue-packed first hour this morning and a few tips that we hope will help you with your Christmas. First up is a high-level look into the issues surrounding the government's draft communication bill, sent back to the government by the House of Lords last week for more thought. Possibly one of the most important pieces of legislation that this Parliament will have to debate, and one that very, very many people know very little about. First up, we have Michael Drury, the former Director of Legal Services for GCHQ until only 2 years ago. Michael is going to tell us about why it is that the government wants to hold, possibly, all of our data for 2 years. That's every single bit of communications data that goes out onto the internet. Michael is noteworthy also because he was the man who was behind the creation of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which is the legislation that is being superseded by the draft communications bill. The Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act meant that the government had the ability to ask for our data to be held in terms of communication records by the telecommunication companies if they so wished to look back over them. That data had to be held for a year. Now they want to have a lot more of our data. Michael Drury tells us more.
The government have been pretty clear about the motivations. The first, I think, is the proliferation of the means of communication. Things have moved on extensively since RIPA was put in place and came into effect in October 2000, notably in the explosion of internet communications, and more recently, in particular, in social media as a means of communicating rather than simply leaving messages for individuals. So the first is the proliferation of communications, and whether or not the present legislation formulated in arguably the dawn of the internet age is good enough to cover all of these situations. The second really is the ephemeral nature of communications data as it appears today. Service providers have little incentive to retain communications data in the traditional sense one thinks about that. The ways by which people communicate and the identifiers of how they've communicated. Compare and contrast that with the situation in the telecoms world, where billing was entirely dependent upon the capacity to render an accurate record of what phone calls had been made and for how long, and indeed over and beyond that the industry regulator required people to put in place billing systems which had sufficient accuracy to ensure that bills were themselves accurate. Mm-hmm. So there is that motivation as well. For me, the third motivation is in the ever-burgeoning cybersecurity field. Today, we're beginning to see what many have predicted for some time, namely an outbreak of cybersecurity incidents. Indeed, in relation to this potential legislation, one of the takeovers of the Home Office website was said to be motivated by the fear of what the legislation might contain. And because cybersecurity manifests itself through the internet, through communication networks, clearly the way that one is going to defeat and deter cybersecurity threats is through understanding how those networks operate, and from whence the threats come. You do that actually through collecting communications data. So I think those three motivations together account for the need for a change. Okay, having said that, I would sum up by saying, in reality, RIPA has proved to be pretty tractable for the 12-year period it's been in force, particularly when one considers just how much has changed about the communications landscape in that dozen years.
Okay, just to pick up one thing that you said there, you said that it was the original idea behind the legislation was to actually be able to monitor phone conversations, etc. And you said that now there are messages that are left. I mean, do you want to sort of draw through on that? What is this additional information that the people who are looking after our best interests want to actually find? What is this additional information?
Okay, well, of course, what the Home Office, in some of the stuff they've posted on the web and their own websites, have said is that there will be no fundamental change to the principle set out in RIPA, namely that if the contents of a communication, that is, me saying to you words, or me sending to you images, or me sending to you a text, requires interception, then you have to go to the highest levels in government. The Secretary of State will have to issue a warrant, and that will follow. I think what has changed is that before, and in the telephone age, all you could really do was establish that a particular number had called another particular number. Of course, you could work through and identify the real person or the real address which lay behind the numbers. But all you could do was say who had called whom, how long the call had been for, and what time the call had started and what time it had terminated. And because of the requirements in billing systems for them to be accurate, you could use that information with a high degree of accuracy as to what was involved, at least as far as timing, duration, and fact of calling was concerned. Of course, with the internet, the data available is a much, much richer environment. One can arguably look at browsing histories. One can look at a vast range of interactions over and above simply the time of an event, which used to be the case. So nowadays, one can theoretically begin to look at a person's interactions on the web more generally, simply by looking at the machine they are using and the sort of events which are happening.
I mean,
events tells you something much, tell you arguably much more about the individual, and they provide a richer, richer vein of information for those who would seek to use it as intelligence. The government would say only necessary and proportionally as intelligence.
Okay, now, I mean, that's really getting to the nub of it, isn't it, Michael? Because, you know, I mean, what would any changes mean to the individual? Well, what people are getting excited about is that it is that very, very rich layer of information, or those rich layers of information that the government is now talking about accessing. So, and what are we actually talking here? I mean, just so we're very clear, what is the information that the government is talking about wanting to now monitor?
Well, again, I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and I go back to the original, as it was then, the so-called IMP, Interception Modernisation Programme, as it was labelled publicly back in 2008-2009. At that stage, no draft legislation was presented. And the answer to your question, I'm afraid, has to be a bit of a lawyer's answer to your question, because until we actually seen the draft legislation that is promised, until we actually see that, we won't know exactly what the legislation purports to cover. In general terms, I think it covers two things. It covers an area of requiring data to be retained, for the reasons I talked about a few minutes ago. The ephemeral nature of the data means that there has to be an obligation imposed upon service providers to retain the data. Otherwise, it will disappear because they have no good reason to keep it. And the second area will be amendments to the present system by which certain types of communications data, and that's the real nub of this, but we won't know exactly how far the legislation purports to go until we see the words which are suggested are contained in the bill. It will, the legislation will obviously have to deal with a system by which, from within the retained data, data is to be drawn back by investigating and intelligence agencies, and used by them for analysis to produce intelligence. So you can expect, surely, to see changes in the drafting from presently to ensure that a broader range of internet type data, perhaps going into packet inspection, are contained in the statute. But how that's going to play out will not be clear until we see the legislation. But it has to be said, I take the view it will be a very difficult job to draft that, and I don't envy those who have the job of doing so.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, if we look at what form any monitoring and surveillance takes, yeah, the information really that anybody would be after would be as much as possible. If you actually circumscribe or you know, say I only want to have particular portions of this information, then you're not going to get the whole picture. So
absolutely, and one of the problems here is the speed with which technology is moving. And the clash which you see with the traditional form of legislation in which you are able to write a law which has a shelf life of certainly, hopefully, 10 years, perhaps more than 10 years, and whether or not that is going to work in this particular environment. I think you're right in one sense, that clearly those bodies charged with producing intelligence, whether that be the intelligence security agencies, whether that be the police, want to have the maximum flexibility to produce intelligence. Of course they do, to do their jobs properly and efficiently. Having said that, my own experience of government is that people involved in this area are very cautious about behaving in a way which doesn't breach the central principles of the Human Rights Act, namely the requirements for necessity and the requirements for acting in a proportionate way. So, yes, they clearly want to adopt the maximum maximalist position they can, but on the other hand, they will be very keen, particularly given the controversy that surrounds this, and the acknowledgement on their side as well, I think, that it has the potential to infringe civil liberties greatly. They want to do that in a way which provides real assurances of necessity and proportionality.
But for this to work, you're going to have to actually collect a great big pool of data on people. Yeah, on everybody, so that you can go back and look at that data. So, to an extent, you've already breached their human rights, particularly English law, because, you know, you're not, you're innocent till proven guilty, yet your data is being held as a pool from which the guilty can be selected.
And the answer to that question, in a legal sense, I think comes in from the understanding the requirement of necessity. The way the argument will be put is that it is now necessary to retain a degree, an amount of data, a very large amount of data, and I don't disagree with your proposition there, on individuals. However, because you'll see effectively a two-stage process, data will need to be retained, but actually the agencies who are interested in exploiting the data will not be allowed, as a function of law, or at least I assume this is how the legislation will be framed, they won't be allowed, as a function of law, to actually look at the data, review the data, call the data from, and again, what I presume will be effectively some sort of escrow account in which it is held, unless they have another authority, which authority will be subject to scrutiny by the Interception of Communications Commissioner. There's a number of assumptions in that theory, but that's how I assume it would work. Now, one of the issues, of course, is whether or not the level of officials who are going to be calling for the data is sufficiently high, what the individual checks and balances in that system are, and in particular, the extent to which ex post facto review of officials' actions is rigorous enough. What you see presently in the Interception of Communications Commissioner's work is a very rigorous system in relation to communications content. One might now argue that given what can be done in terms of describing an individual simply from communications data, that a more rigorous analysis ought to be done after the fact by the Interception of Communications Commissioner and his staff.
That was Michael Drury, the former Director of Legal Affairs at GCHQ, who now is a partner at the Lawyers BCL. Next up is Colin Duffy. Colin is the chief executive of VoIPhone, an internet telephone company that is extremely interested in the progress of the government's draft communication bill. And, Colin...
Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well apart from this cold, so apologise for the snotty sounding voice.
That's okay. I think it's probably seasonal. the draft communications bill, I understand that there are some issues as far as the telecommunications industry is concerned, there are some points that you'd like to make about it.
There's quite a few. I mean, I suppose I have three hats on. I'm obviously a user of communications, and I'm interested in what the government and its agencies are doing with the information it gathers about me. I own a telephone company, so whatever they need from me has consequences to my business, one way or another. And I'm a director and council member of ITSBA, which is the trade body for the VoIP industry in the UK, and we've been asked to give information to various committees and respond to the communications draft bill generally. So there's kind of three positions I take on it. I suppose the major concern for the industry in general is about just what is needed by this bill. It's very, very vague as it stands, and it's very, very wide-ranging. And if I was writing a bill, that's exactly what I'd do, because then it would be in some extent future-proof, which is a bit of a frightening term. As the owner of a company, what we want to know is specifically, in detail, what is required of us. And without knowing that, we don't know what it will cost us, whether it's possible to be done, and what other problems it might have.
Right. Now, when you say, you know, what needs to be done, what do you suspect will need to be done? I mean, there is obviously the RIPA legislation that's currently in place, and under RIPA, you have to, I understand, hold details of the phone records that people are making, and that includes the phone conversations themselves. And I think that's for up to a year now, isn't it? So what do you currently do?
Well, currently we're obliged to keep what are called call data records for a minimum of a year, and that's European-wide legislation now, and has been for some time. And what that means is that we need to keep the names, address, telephone number information, and any other information about the customer, like his bank details and so on, plus details of every call that he or she makes or receives, who it goes to, what time it happened, the duration of the call, the number called, and so on and so on. That's the call data record. We've got to keep all that for a year. And of course, as your number of customers increases, the amount of data that you have to keep on them obviously increases exponentially. So that's a cost to us. But actually, we have to have that information anyway, so that's not a big problem for us. We do need to know who called who and how much it cost so that we can raise a bill on them. So having that information is no big overhead. Saving it for longer than we would normally need it is an overhead, but a year we think is feasible. In practice, we keep it for much longer, but a year is what we're required to keep it to. You did say that we have to record the content of those calls, which we don't have to do, and in fact it's illegal to do so. The content of the call is, you know, recording this conversation between you and me and the rest of the world. We don't record the calls. It is possible to do that, but we require a signature from the Home Office, and it's a very big deal and very, very rarely happens. Whereas under RIPA, we're fairly regularly asked information to help the police sort out crimes, which we're very happy to do.
And that's completely fine, isn't it? But yeah. I understand that, that there might be, and according to the interview we've just heard with Michael Drury, that there is a desire to hold all of this information in digital form. Now, that does actually involve content. That does involve what people have been doing on their social media pages. And it does, I assume, involve their email as well.
Yeah, I mean, the Comms Data Act and the new bill, as proposed, is trying to extend the reach of RIPA beyond telephone calls and the data generated by them to everything we do on the internet, which websites we visit, where emails are sent to, and so on and so forth, instant messages, everything. And there are very good reasons for the government wanting that information, of course, because criminals use new media to help them commit crimes. And everybody wants to support any action that's proportionate to stop that happening. The trouble is, and the real concerns start, when it's not specified what will be collected, by whom, how often, where it's kept, what oversight there is of it, and so on. And on the telecom side, we're really concerned mostly about these things called special notices and filters.
So what are they?
This is where an agency wishes to have a direct connection into your network and collect information within our network without our knowledge, and then allow the agency in their own time to go through all the data and collect what they wish. At the moment, the way things work is if the police are investigating a crime, they know who it is, they roughly know information about them, they request information from us one at a time. So one telephone number, one RIPA request. We get a RIPA request in, it has to be signed by the right person, it has to be through an authorised single point of contact. We can call the Home Office and check that that person is authorised to get this information, and then we give it them. There's lots of humans in the process, and we can control access to our data. If somebody's got a line into our network to a black box that's collecting information from our network, we have no idea what's going on in there, and nobody has any control about what is being done with it.
And so, but why would that interest you? You're a business, and the intelligence agencies would arguably say, well, that's their business.
I'm a business. I'm also a citizen. I dislike that as a citizen. As a business, I dislike it because people are interfering with our database. And our database is the most valuable thing that I own. It's the record of all our customers and all their accounts and all their information. And we all know what happens when governments get hold of that sort of information. It generally appears somewhere else, doesn't it?
I wouldn't know, but there seem to have been very many occasions when data...
Left on a train.
...does hold on as have been to... inadvertently appearing in other places. We don't know that the two CDs that contained the details of every family in the country, we don't know what happened to them, but they were lost.
Yeah. At the moment, I'm responsible under various acts for the data held on my network. As a responsible company, I shouldn't be allowed to let anybody have access to that data that I can no longer control, should I?
No. I think under the Data Protection Act, you are obliged, and you can suffer a very, very heavy penalty. Would the government obtaining that information and then losing it, if that were the case, would that mean that you were no longer responsible? I think it doesn't, does it?
Well, who knows? I don't have enough lawyers to work that one out.
No, and Are there any other issues apart from the ones that you've mentioned particularly? I mean, one of the points that Michael Drury has made is that because of the onward movement and the fast pace of technology, that it will be something that will be very, very, very difficult to legislate on. That's the first point. And the second point is that the to actually define what it is that they want will be a huge task.
I think it will be almost impossible for them to do that, and a lot of comfort that we have in this process is knowing that those wanting this information are actually incompetent to collect it, and it's at the practical level that this will probably all go wrong, and because they'll find that A, they don't have the skills to do it, and B, that the costs of doing it are enormous. I think they're claiming in the bill that it's going to be $1.8 billion over 10 years. Well, nobody in our industry believes a word of that.
Right. OK. Have they got some other figure that they feel is probably more likely?
10 times that.
10 times?
But guessing. Completely guessing. Because we don't actually know what they want to do. It's that vague.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, hopefully we should be able to put a bit more clarity on all of that. That was Colin Duffy, executive of VoIPhone, which is an internet telephony company, which will be much affected by the legislation. Now, next on, we have Bjorn Rupp. Bjorn is an encryption expert who formerly worked for one of the European intelligence agencies. And to go to some of the points that Colin Duffy was making about the information that they currently have to hold under RIPA, such as bank account information and addresses, well, Bjorn actually puts a very, very different spin on how valuable that sort of information can be.
The general background is, of course, that from a government perspective, especially from a law enforcement perspective, if you have all the telecom data for the past 6 months and you come up with, you know, whatever inquiry you might have, that data hides a lot of information inside. So you can easily determine, okay, not just who called whom, but also who was traveling from where to where, how many typical partners does this person have, and you can also from that data you can employ advanced data mining techniques and then find out, for instance, not so much like, okay, I have this one person, what is he doing now, but I'm trying to find a certain person and the system will generate that for me, identify that person even though I don't know him yet. Does it make any sense?
No, absolutely. I mean, because the issues that are raised here, and they're raised on a frequent basis, they were raised when RIPA was first suggested, was that this meant that the entire population was under surveillance and every conversation and every... And now, but what people are saying is that every email will be looked at. Is that the case, or is it more the case that people will say, no, there are people that I am interested in, and because I am interested in them, I will then go and look at their data retrospectively?
The underlying issue is that once you store the data, once you have it, it's very easy for the data to be misused. I mean, the UK is a state where a country where the rule of law is still very well enforced. In other countries, that is definitely not the case. And there, the data is going to be used at will. And the trend in so-called intelligence support systems, these are the systems that are installed by governments to monitor the telecommunications behavior of the population. The trend in these systems is to correlate a lot of data from various sources and so allow you to A, profile an individual to great detail, much greater detail than was possible, let's say, 10 or 20 years ago, and B, these systems, as I've previously said, also allow you to identify abnormal behavior. Like, for instance, a person typically... let's say travels from home to work and back and then, you know, calls his colleagues, a few friends, so you can automatically define what is normal communication behavior. And then, you know, when certain patterns are detected, for instance, suddenly this one person who has normally always traveled back and forth between two locations has an average call volume of, let's say, X calls per day. Now suddenly this guy starts calling five other guys. These five other guys also call five other people each. Now that's a typical pattern for organizations that may rise suspicion, or for criminal organizations, terrorist organizations, and so on and so on. Now then, now the system will automatically weed through this enormous amount of data and then identify abnormal behavior and alert the analyst, okay, here there's abnormal behavior. And that is, on the one hand, of course, a fascinating option for especially the intelligence community. On the other hand, it also raises a lot of concerns for data privacy, and essentially everyone is a suspect. No matter how you put it from a legal perspective, but the technology really makes everyone a suspect if it's deployed like that. And then once there is a court order, you can retrospectively find out pretty much everything about that individual.
Right. So what you're saying is that the systems can be actually deployed. In a sense, this is almost a response to the potential of what you can do in the cloud as well, because you can detect various different patterns in the cloud, and by that agglomeration of data, you can get much more from it, because it allows you to generate richer patterns. So what you're saying is that, and this is just currently with call pattern analysis, that you can actually cross-reference the call patterns, say, of a terrorist cell, and find people who might be replicating similar sort of call patterns.
Yeah, call patterns is one thing, and then, of course, since you also lock, like for mobile phones, you also lock the data from where a call is being made and where it is being received. You also know a lot about from where to where these people are moving. Because whenever a call is made, you also know, okay, it's coming from cell ABC. So now, for instance, you're moving from central London to wherever, Manchester and back, and suddenly you're going to Scotland and meeting all these other people who have also traveled there to one single location, and so you can derive a lot of information from the data. And what should also be noticed there, I mean, from a legal point of view, there's a distinction between what can be used in court and what is already being used by the intelligence community. All advanced countries in the world have now deployed advanced intelligence support systems to varying degrees, but they all have these systems. So what we're usually seeing in the public discussion is just the tip of the iceberg, really, because there we're concerned about what can be used in court. But what is already possible for the intelligence services, that's an entirely different matter. The technology is already there, and I'm very, very much afraid that sooner or later vast amount of this data will get into the wrong hands. I mean, think about it. Today you can easily smuggle gigabytes and gigabytes of data in a small card that you could hide under your fingernail. And sooner or later this data will get into the wrong hands, and then, you know, we'll come to the blackmail game, and I don't even want to think about what is going to happen.
And we're just talking at the moment about calls. So if one extends that into internet searches, internet search histories, information contained, because what's being proposed now is that we look at internet messenger systems.
Mm-hmm.
And also header information in internet messenger systems as well. So, you know, the fact that somebody it's not somebody to a conversation taking place, it's the fact that somebody tried to make a call, and that
correct.
Could have some...
And then you can correlate that with credit card data and with electronic messaging data, with IP access data, and you get a pretty complete picture of a person. That person becomes very, very transparent. And only, you know, people got very concerned about 1984, and today in 2012, no one seems to grasp that we have already passed this stage. We're not yet at the mind reading stage, but apart from that, it has become a nightmare.
Sure, because I think doubly concerning is the fact somebody sent me some information yesterday about a technology system called Zebra, which apparently they discovered was being used by Colonel Gaddafi, although one could arguably say it didn't do him much good. What is the desire, then, in terms of bringing internet messaging systems, social networks, and all those other technologies in line with this monitoring and surveillance technology, is that this just increases the capacity, the information that's available.
When you put yourself into the shoes of an analyst or an intelligence agency or a police force whose job it is to just find the needle in the haystack, then it's very tempting. You have technology at your fingertips that makes your job much easier. But it's a really double-edged sword. On the one side, yes, this can be helpful to identify terrorists, etc., etc. But on the other hand, it's also the perfect suppression tool. And when you think about these civil liberties that we are rightly proud of, and what widespread deployment of that technology means for the practical exercise of these civil liberties, you really start to worry. So, of course, there's always a temptation to deploy this technology because it makes the job of many people much easier. But in the end, you might, even with the best intentions, create a police state without even knowing it. And you know, once you have the infrastructure in place, and the procedures and all that, just think about it, how quick a regime change could mean that data is now no longer being used by a benevolent state, but by a dictator. I mean, not necessarily in the UK, but just think of other countries.
No, I agree completely. I mean, but so what I just spoke to a former senior very senior official at GCHQ, who said that as far as he was concerned, and I quote, he said that the day of the terrorist is over. So why are people doing this? What is the threat? What is the data? What is the data that you're looking for that is going to be a threat to your your state? Because that goes back to what you're saying, is why have it?
I find that question difficult to answer because I have always argued against. I also believe that a lot of arguments are being made that, like, you know, well, we need to fight the terrorists, we need to fight organized crime, etc., etc. But that may not always be the true agenda.
Right.
But I can only speculate about the true motivation.
I'm sure. You say you've always argued against too much data collection. I mean, the reasons for that, when we talked about that potential for suppression, is another reason for that it could be just too much data.
You mean too much in the terms of it's difficult to analyze?
Yeah. Or is it very easy to analyze?
Well, for humans, it's of course way too much data, I completely agree, but I mean, that's what all the manufacturers of these intelligence support systems do in these days. They come up with clever algorithms because an analyst can impossibly sift through all this enormous mountain of data manually. The system really does that automatically, and then the system, like very modern systems, can even define by themselves what they're looking for, essentially establish rules automatically with rule-based reasoning. Okay, what defines normality? What does define abnormal behavior? What is reason for concern? And then the system will bring these cases to the station of the analyst, and then the analyst will have a look at it, and then and only then will he actually listen to the call or look at what is going on. But the system will already relieve the analyst of a lot of, or makes the workload of the analyst much lighter by doing the entire pre-computation, pre-collection, pre-analysis automatically. The general
okay, right. Now, we've got Paul Down of Spectrosoft on the line now. Paul is the sales manager for the European part of Spectrosoft, which is an organisation which has some extremely innovative technology that it uses to help people actually find out what the sort of things are that their children are doing on their technology, and also what their employees do. Some people would perhaps argue that this is much more of this surveillance system, and that there is a need for people to actually think about this and think about its ramifications. But Paul, in terms of Spectrosoft, why? What is the raison d'être for Spectrosoft? Why is it that you feel that people would be interested in using your products? And evidently, a lot of people do.
Yeah, they do. Good afternoon. The foundation of this company was very much built around a software or technology that mums and dads would buy to protect their children, whether it be online, on the PC at home, on the Mac, or on their smartphone as well. And what we see is that parents want to be alerted to inappropriate behaviour, inappropriate relationships people are making, but also alerting parents when a child's phone breaches a physical geographic barrier. For example, my son leaves town, I want to know about it, type thing. So from that technology, we then developed a user activity monitoring solution for business. And the benefit that companies are getting from that is the ability to enforce their acceptable use of IT policy, the ability to actually lock down the assets. But with that monitoring, obviously, comes the ability to monitor things like staff productivity, but probably more importantly, to protect the physical assets as well as the data and the IP for a business.
Right. So it's not that we are now in an age when surveillance has become sort of, to use a highfalutin term, ubiquitous. It's that we're now in an age where, because of the technology allows people to do a lot of things that they couldn't do before, and it allows them to have contact in a way that they couldn't before. And the sort of rationale is that there is now a need to monitor something that didn't exist before. Is that it?
Yeah, pretty much, because with the consumerization of IT, the bring-your-own-device, people are working anywhere, whether it be home, mobile, in the office, on a plane or train. So there's been a requirement to monitor and lock down, or to use the phrase DLP, for some time. But there are some inherent issues with that, where locking down a device, if someone's has the intent to do something fraudulent, or to leak some data, they'll find other ways of doing it. So we come at it at a slightly different angle, where we know that the majority of data breaches in the business are actually done by the staff themselves. So it should really be the staff that we're monitoring. The staff are used to an acceptable use of IT policy. They are. And I think that with the current economic climate, the staff share the same ambitions in terms of longevity, profit, and security in the role as well as their company. So we're not seeing any issues with staff or employers who are employing an activity monitoring solution.
Oh, arguably as well, you could say, couldn't you, that, that the staff too should be able to make a claim on those records that you hold. So it could be a protection for the staff too.
Absolutely. What we've found is that the evidence that we've created because of the monitoring, you know, that's been used in the court of law on many occasions by police forces, particularly the anti-corruption units. Now, what's important about reviewing that data is making sure that, you know, was something that was done, was it intentional or was it accidental? So the ability to actually review in context what happened on that device is very, very important. So what did someone do before? What do they do during the action? What do they do after? You know, and painting a picture like that gives you true visibility to understand, you know, is it right or is it wrong? And on the other end of the scale, you know, we have, you know, we help organizations who have HR issues. You know, if someone is making a claim against another employee, using our technology, you have that evidence or that proof to say, yes, actually something has been happening, or no, it hasn't. So, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, we don't have access to that data. That data sits in a database repository on the customer site within the firewall, and they use their existing security measures to protect that data. And as you said, if an employee wants to review that data, if there's a valid claim there's no reason why the employer shouldn't do that.
Right. So, I mean, obviously they would have to know that the technology was being deployed. But I mean, the essential argument that you're making is that we do seem to be moving towards a world, not necessarily of surveillance, but a world of transparency where all of this information is held, and then people, what they're doing is becoming much more transparent in a way that, again, was never, ever, ever possible before.
Yeah, I think that organisations are trying to empower their staff more to, you know, in terms of flexible working, in terms of hours and where they work, because, you know, you don't always get the best out of everyone just from sitting at a desk from 9 till 5:30. So, giving people the tools to do the job is important, but it's, you know, the protection of the company and their assets is also important as well. You know, which is why, you know, organisations deploy user activity monitoring.
Right. Now, do you, I mean, some people would say, no, this is terrible, you know, the world's gone mad, and everybody is now under surveillance, and everything that they're doing is under surveillance. That seems to be an argument that you're sort of rejecting. You're saying, no, there is a need for this surveillance for all sorts of reasons. I mean, just to one point, to actually, because this embraces everything, doesn't it? This embraces everything that somebody will be doing on the internet. It involves their social media, their email, their, does it also involve their text messages?
Yeah, so it's important to understand that when the recording agent is placed on a device, that device is owned by the organisation, because, you know, it's a corporate asset that needs to be secured. In terms of, you know, what it records, yes, of course it does internet, but it goes much more than that. So it's pretty much anything you physically do on a device at your desk is recorded. Whether your activity is a centrally delivered application or service, or whether it's a local running service as well. And obviously of things like the BlackBerry devices, the Android phones and such like. But what's important to note is the fact that organizations who deploy this technology have the choice to choose what to record and what not to record. So it's very much policy driven. You know, you may have different profiles for different teams or different individuals. But, you know, you mentioned the internet there. You know, we'll monitor instant messenger conversations, websites visited. And when you consider that a lot of people may have, for example, a social media site open all day, our technology will say, well, yes, that person's been on that social media site all day. However, they only had that screen open for 30 minutes, but actually only did something on that screen for 2 or 3 minutes. So we talked about context earlier, but the ability to determine exactly what that person is doing is important. Interesting, you mentioned the social media element, because, you know, we have customers who, you know, have been very high-profile cases in the news where, you know, data has been leaked, customer records have been lost, you know, resulting fines from the ICO. You know, these sort of actions can be very costly to, you know, not only the value of the company but the brand erosion. You know, so I think that social media is something that everyone needs to embrace, not only in terms of helping build the business, but also to protect the business as well, to make sure that people aren't putting inappropriate things on social media.
Okay, wonderful. Paul, that was very, very, very good of you to come on. That was Paul Down of Spectrosoft, a company that is... actually, Paul, it's just one point before I do cut you off. Going back to this, you mentioned bring your own device. I mean, bring your own device is something that I don't think very many people are aware of. Just tell me, I mean, bring your own device is when somebody is working for a company and they decide to, say, perhaps use their own phone. Then, as a result of that, there are things that they do, and that means that they could be using that phone for their company's work, and so the company thinks that it should have some sort of ability to oversee that. Is that right?
Sure, yeah, so... The bring your own device theme is very fashionable and popular at the moment, but it's also a minefield because, as you quite rightly said, you know, people are bringing their smartphones into work now, and the first thing they're doing is linking it to a Wi-Fi and setting up their exchange account on their phone. So, you know, that is an additional endpoint which organisations need to be aware of in terms of DLP threats. So it's a theme which nobody really knows what to do. Every vendor has their own take on this, but, you know, if you're looking at exchange accounts, for example, you know, that's often a centrally delivered service, which means that's something that we can monitor. So if someone is sending something, whether it be intentional or accidental on the phone, that's something we'll capture. But bring your own device is a very broad and fashionable theme at the moment, and it's these guys who are bringing their iPads to work and their Android phones and their iPhones, and it's just creating a significant security threat to every organization.
Brilliant. Paul, thank you very, very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Now we have a Melissa Hathaway. Melissa Hathaway is President Obama's former cyber czar. She was former acting cyber czar, to be more accurate, before the appointment of Mr. Schmidt. But Melissa has some very, very interesting views on this whole notion of surveillance, and they're not perhaps exactly what you would expect from a prominent US official. Or prominent.
I believe that there is already, in the United States, there's already a law in place called CALEA.
Right.
Which, are you familiar with CALEA?
I've heard of it. I'm not familiar with what it means, no.
Effectively, it says that service providers must store the content for a period of time of all traffic. That in the event that there is discovered a crime, you know, at some point in some future date, that the law enforcement community could subpoena said carrier for set data for evidence collection to, you know, for this discovery and trail of evidence, chain of evidence.
Uh-huh.
So I believe that that is in place, and I'm trying to. I just googled CALEA. I'm not coming. Oh, that's because I didn't Google it. I went on my computer for CALEA. That didn't help. The CALEA basically is something that's already out there for forced storage.
Okay, but I mean, what people are talking about here is that there should be. Online access by the intelligence and security services to that store of information. I mean, you talk about ISPs could be subpoenaed for that information. It doesn't seem to be what's being suggested here. That seems to have the necessary safeguards that seem to be concerning people.
Yeah, from what I read, from what you sent me, it looks like what is being proposed in the United Kingdom is more like a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act equivalent, or more what I would perhaps say unfettered access by the intelligence community to that data store. We are all nations of laws, and I believe that it's very important to have the law govern the activities of the government when it comes to our information. So I believe that you should not have unfettered access to a data store that was collected against all citizens.
Yeah, of course. That seem to be the thing that's creating disquiet. Going back to, because obviously the rationale behind a lot of the measures that are occurring now is it's either to protect us against terrorism or it's to try to detect illegal patterns of behaviour from cyber criminals and to try to in some way deal with all of that. Your proposals in terms of making the internet safer by requiring the internet service providers to do a lot more, do you think that is the best way then to deal with a lot of the cyber criminality that's out there?
I've written another paper. I think the internet service providers, if they publish statistics about the number of infections that they're seeing on their networks, and that happens in some countries, not all countries, the number of customers who had their data stolen or illegally copied, which, the United Kingdom has a pretty robust data breach law, whereas the United States doesn't. I think that people will begin to have better understanding of what needs to be done. I think that it's incumbent upon the internet service providers, and I define that pretty broad, that if they are hosting activity on their infrastructure that is illegal, then they have the duty to shut that down. Now, illegal already being defined by the law.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the selling of our credit card data, or the example I use is the illegal pharmaceuticals in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is going to be more and more important, because otherwise it's another safe harbor for the criminal activity.
But won't the response to that be, yes, but lots of this stuff is coming from abroad, we can't close the stuff down abroad? Are you then suggesting that the internet service providers should lock out those people who are sending that information from abroad, or some way quarantine their services?
I think that they would quarantine their services, because otherwise then they're aiding and abetting the criminal activity, and then they are in fact liable themselves.
No.
So they either choose not to service that customer base, right? Or, right? I mean, it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to provide you service. And if I choose to provide you service and I find out that you are conducting illicit activities on my infrastructure, at the end of the day, you're in trouble and I'm in trouble. Because if it's my infrastructure and I'm hosting illegal activity, known illegal, defined illegal activity, right?
Yep.
Then I'm in to be prosecuted in whichever country it was defined as illegal.
And what you also are saying, it seems to be the position of one of transparency, which is, come on, let's just be a bit more intelligent about this. Let's stop trying to pretend it's all so complex and just say, if we make things more transparent, if we're more aware of the issue, then we know what we need to do to deal with it.
Yes, I am absolutely arguing for the transparency and use of the current laws in place, and then I think the transparency will bring about citizen awareness of what needs to be done and social responsibility. The transparency will also bring data into the open so you can encourage innovation for perhaps unique technologies could be brought in place to solve the problem better. And the transparency, I think, will also impose almost a political requirement for cross-border, international cooperation to solve the problem.
Right.
And right now everybody's hiding behind the veil of secrecy or the veil of it's too difficult, or, and it is a very complex problem, but I think that at least in the proposal that I put forward in you know, this area, I have another proposal in another area, that if we break down the problem into, you know, things that we already understand and the infrastructure that's already in place, and it's a small number of real players that could, you know, begin to make a big difference.
Well, I mean, I profoundly, totally, and absolutely agree with you. I mean, you're just expounding the things that I've actually sort of been saying for a long time. I mean, I've been a passionate believer in transparency, because I was talking to a lawyer from GCHQ last night who was saying that you can't have transparency because if you're going to do this sort of surveillance and monitoring, then you can't let people know how you're getting the information, because then they will learn how to evade it. And when I mentioned that to other people today, they said, well, that was what worried them, was that because there wasn't a transparency about this monitoring and tracking down of criminals, etc., etc., and knowing how the data was being used, that was what made them unwilling to participate in the exercise, because a collection of data like that makes everybody in the state a suspect and impairs the relationship between you and the state. Now, obviously, if you have a transparent system where you can say, look, here is the issue, here is the problem, there are this amount of people and they are doing these sorts of things, then you can start to deal with it, and you've actually got the subjects of the state hand in hand with you wanting to do that, because they can see the damage that it's potentially doing to them.
Yes, I agree with you. When people talk about and use the I guess the opacity argument of we can't tell everybody because it'll just it'll reveal sources and methods, or the adversary or the bad guys or the criminals will change their tactics. I then go to the counter argument and talk about what Google and Facebook are doing as aggregating the data and, you know, collecting and selling information for marketing and for other purposes. And, again, one could argue they're being transparent about it, but not many people realize the aggregate amount of data that they have on any one of us. And then if we were to bring more transparency, would you opt out of that model? Yeah, would you stop using Gmail? Would you stop using Google Search? Would you stop using Google Maps? Would you stop using Facebook? You know, I go back to the adage, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah.
And so you got the free service, but the cost is your data. I believe that there's already...
Right. There you go. Well, that was Melissa Hathaway, who arguably has really put the cat among the pigeons with some of those points that she was making. You're listening to Password with Peter Warren. It's exploring this new world of technology and the internet. We're live every Monday morning on Radio Castle at www.radiocastle.com. Or you can listen again or download the podcast. And you can also join us on Facebook or call the studio on 07538 080815. Remember, password is all you need to know. I've got John Godfrey coming in. We've been talking ever such a lot about the fact that there is a lot of data out there on us. And one of the things that people now have got reconciled to is that there is such a huge amount of data out there on us. But one of the things that people don't actually think about is, what do you do when you want to destroy that data? I mean, obviously, we've got this information now on computer servers, we've got it on our computers, we've got it on our hard drives, and there are organisations like Spectrosoft which are making sure that there is other information also on hard drives. We've heard from Colin Duffy saying that he's very, very, very concerned about the sort of information that he has on his computers, and that he doesn't really want that to go off his computers because he's responsible responsible for it. Now, John Godfrey, who hopefully is on the line, is a director of Sims Recycling. Sims have been pioneers in the destruction of data. In fact, they've done probably more than any other company to raise awareness of this issue. John, are you there?
I am, Pete. Hi. Good to speak to you.
I understand you're suffering a little from a cold.
I am. I'm a little bit blocked up, but I've just had a Lemsip, so hopefully you can hear me clearly.
Good. Well, I can hear you fine, and I hope that as a result of Beecham's, that you're going to be a great broadcast for us.
I'll do my best, but if I cough and splutter, I'll try not to make too much noise.
I think we'll forgive you for that. Now, John, what is, you know, I mean, how much data, well, we've on the programme so far, we've been talking about all of the different databases there are that people can take advantage of, all of the other data that's becoming available because of internet technologies like the cloud. How much data do we actually throw out when we actually decide that we've had enough of our old computers?
There's an absolutely vast amount of data. It's so big, I can't put a number on it. But I mean, I got a relatively small hard drive in my hand right now, and there's enough information on this particular drive that holds 125,000 paperback books. Now, this particular drive I've been using for some backups. I've been storing information on it personally, and I know that in the wrong hands, that data can be used to build a whole profile of me as a person, my habits, my interests, my, you know, and enough information there to steal my identity. So it's a huge challenge. The data that is being collected and captured on individuals is growing at a frightening rate because of, as you were just explaining, because they're it's just being stored in so many different places now. And I mean, I shop online. I know that the online businesses, especially the major ones, keep a history of what I'm interested in. And I also know when my daughters have been looking on sites like Amazon, because all of a sudden they think that I have an interest in fairies and horses and things like that. So, I mean, the data being kept against my name, I'm very clear, is in hundreds, if not thousands, of different places, and it's growing at an extraordinary rate.
Now, for over 10 years, you've been doing research with the University of Glamorgan, haven't you?
And that's correct. Yeah.
In that time, a number of hard drives have passed through the experiment to see what data was left on hard drives. Could you just tell us some of the things that actually you found on those hard drives?
Well, the program started really over 10 years ago now, when I was first introduced to you, Pete, and I at the time directed. So had a conversation and suggested where, if you wanted to look, or if somebody wanted to look, where they would be able to find information. And we just chose a computer fair, if you remember. And from just a sample of three PCs that were taken from that computer fair, we found Paul McCartney's personal bank details, the share transactions and the investment profile of a charity, a couple of minor royals. It was an extraordinary discovery. But since that time, we've discovered corporate secrets, we've discovered the design details of a car that had not yet been released. Now, in the wrong hands, of course, if that were to have found its way into, I don't know, perhaps a Chinese business, you know, the implications to that car company could be huge. But more worrying than that, we've also found, and as well as a huge amount of personal data, we've also found, and one example was the launch sequence and launch codes of a Lockheed Martin intercontinental ballistic missile system.
I'm going to have to just correct you slightly. It was a terminal high altitude area defence system.
It was
the last line of defence that the Americans had against nuclear attack. So still an enormously significant system.
I stand corrected. Yes, exactly. Now, the interesting thing about that particular case is, obviously the research is done by the academics. I never get to see the actual data, but my understanding from their report is that that was as a consequence of people or an individual taking work home with them and then using their home computer to do some work and not understanding that information was still present on the hard drive when they disposed of that computer. So a very, very serious breach, of course, but the interesting thing there is there's a huge trend for what the industry calls bring your own, i.e. bring your own device, but you use your own personal pad, smartphone, PC, laptop, or what have you, for your work. As well as, obviously, there's a lot of people working from home. I'm working from home today because of my cold, but I'm sitting here, I've got my work PC, but I've also got my home PC running, and it's very, very easy to lose track of where the important, valuable, high-risk data is actually sitting. And if you copy a file over from a USB stick and copy it onto your home PC, even if you delete it afterwards, there's still the data there, unless you're using some fairly complicated and fairly specialist tools to securely remove it. And that process of removing data is quite technical. It requires some knowledge and some skills. And people are geared up to retaining data. They're constantly paranoid about losing stuff. So when they actually choose to want to destroy it, it's actually very difficult. It's quite complicated.
Right. And, I mean, one of the other things that I don't think that people quite realise is you pointed out how many paperback books there were on the hard drive that you have, but the size of hard drives now is absolutely enormous, isn't it? I mean, what sort of sizes are we talking about?
Well, I mean, a good example, when my first job in IT procurement was working for a high street bank, and at that time one of the big banks, I won't name them, they used to run 20 million customers on 9 terabytes of data storage. You can now go into Tesco's and buy a terabyte USB hard drive for less than £100. So for a tiny amount of money, really, up to what you would have had to pay. Now, I'm in my mid-40s. I was working for the bank in my sort of mid-20s, I suppose, early 20s. But in a relatively, so say in 20 years, you've gone from a whole banking system running on the kind of storage that now, if you've got less than £1,000, you can put across a till in Tesco's. A staggering change in the capacity. And these days, a terabyte hard drive is really quite standard. Even if you look at the end of life, hard drive now is around the 320 gigabytes. So it's huge capacity. And they're all around us. I mean, they're in cars, they're in set-top boxes, they're literally all over the place.
Now, just one final question then. What is it that we would need to do if we wanted to get rid of these? What should we do? What is the process?
Well, there are two choices, really. One is to physically destroy the device, and even doing that, you need to do it, obviously, considering health and safety, and some of the drives contain glass, so you need to be a little bit careful. If you want to reuse the device, and obviously that's preferable because of recycling and reuse, then you should use a tool to overwrite the device, and those tools are available. You can download them from the internet, or you can buy them. If you're a business, then you should be using a tool that is certified, is accredited to your local regulations. If you're in the UK, there's a standard by the government and CESG, which is and the standard is called IS5. That's a government standard. It's not really applicable to commercial businesses, but it's been adopted as the de facto standard. So an accredited tool. And the key thing is actually making sure that the process fails safe, because if you're not using that, those tools correctly, you can end up thinking that you have data wiped and cleared all the residual data on a drive when actually you haven't.
Alternative, John, is user... if I could just interrupt you there.
Sure.
And I'm going to put you on hold just for a moment, if you could.
No problem. Yeah, yeah.
Right. This is Password with Peter Warren. This is the weekly technology programme on Castle Radio that explains new technology and the internet, live every Monday morning on Radio Castle at www.radiocastle.com. Or you can listen again and download the podcast, or you can join us on 07538 080815. Remember, Password is all you need to know. Now, next on, and we're just waiting for him to come back on, is Michael Tumbrill of Pocket Money. Michael has put together a system that allows children aged 8 to 16 to hold money on their mobile phones and to be able to spend it. And it tries to help them to actually come up with a good spending pattern. Now, one of the issues, I suppose, that one has to think about this is, well, with new technology and with the systems of giving of holding information on people, is this something that should be extended down to 8 or 8 year olds? And also, should there be safeguards on all of this information that we are now slushing around about ourselves? We're seeing that data is growing at a rate now that we have never ever seen before, and every day the internet increases that amount of data exponentially, not just because of our mobile phones, but also because of the servers on the internet and because of other devices that we use. The amount of information is actually now it's a deluge. And the amount that we actually control it seems to be almost in inverse proportions to the amount of information that we've got coming in. Hopefully, Michael will be joining us and we will be able to talk to him about all of this. So we're just waiting for him to come through. In the meantime, one of the other points that probably is well worth bearing in mind is passwords. Passwords themselves, that's the name of this programme, and we named it that because we actually felt that your password was the gateway to this new world of the internet, etc., etc. But how do you come up with a password? And what is it that you would do? Well, we here have thought about this, and we decided that it was something that we would give a little bit of advice out on, because passwords, you know, they're the biggest issue in the 21st century. It identifies you and it determines your access and that of your employees to your company information, to your personal information, in fact, to everything. And maintaining those passwords is a huge challenge, because we have, as everybody's mentioned and alluded to, the development of a mobile workforce, this predicted expansion in the use of internet technology via the cloud. What do you actually do when you want to originate a password, and how do you manage that yourself? current advice suggests that you should frequently change your password, that you should use complex passwords, or that you should create passwords using devices known as password generators. Yet that scares a lot of people off. The main reason is trying to remember a complex password is enormously difficult. So as a result of that, those individuals choosing their own passwords will often either use personal information or a combination of personal information to create a code that's memorable for them. Only problem with that is that if somebody asks you their dog's name or your dog's name, then you'll quite frequently give them the opening to all of your systems and all of your information, or the names of your children, or some other names that I would get wrapped across the knuckles for telling you. However, as I say, the disadvantage of that method is basic research into an individual can normally obtain their password. The other problem is that people who use memorable passwords will often use them for every single one of the services that they use. So that means their internet passwords for their home banking, their phone passwords, their computer passwords. And they will use them as the passwords to their LinkedIn pages or their Facebook pages. So that can mean that if somebody works out your one password, that they have got the lot. The other point about that is that with software that is now routinely used by criminals and by other people, that's actually programmed to look for the ludicrously simple passwords first. So it has a list of all of the passwords that are most frequently used by people. And just to let you know, the most frequently used password is password. Then these programs will cycle through those, and within a fraction of seconds they will actually get your password. One of the appear to have a last one of my guests coming in. Hello, hopefully that's Michael Tumbrill. Hello? Hello? Hello, Michael. Well, I'm afraid that we can't bring Michael, so I am actually going to go back to my discussion of passwords, which I will carry on with until he gets through to me. According to police officers who investigate unauthorised access to computers, most passwords are stored within 1 metre of the PC. Hello, Michael. Hello?
Hello.
Ah, hi. Is this, this is Ubi, is it?
This is Elizabeth Kilby.
Oh, Elizabeth. I'm sorry, every programme we have a minor communications meltdown, and it's just been hitting me at this precise moment. So as a result of that, I have... I've basically been playing sort of a lucky dip with phone numbers and names. Anyway, Elizabeth, thank you very, very much for coming on. We were hoping to have had Michael Tumbrill on before you, who was going to be telling us about this practice of giving pocket money to children via an app. You're a psychologist specialising in children. Now... What is your take on this increasing sort of aptization of children, or this use of apps and of social media, etc., etc.? What do you think about this?
Well, as a psychologist and a parent, I have loads of contact with families, and I feel that I'm quite in touch with some of the things that they're struggling with. So I know that this is a concern for families. Children increasingly using technology, they're actually quite gifted at it, they kind of get and connect with it really easily. So this is a reality of the world that my children live in and other families are experiencing. And so my take on this is really pragmatic. We need to give them the skills that they need to survive in the real world, and we need to do it really safely, and we need to guide and coach them and take care of them. And that would be my both personal and professional position.
Right. Now, and what would that sort of coaching, what form would that coaching take? What sort of things would you say? I mean, do you think that for example, that technology has become invasive? Well, I mean, obviously it's pervasive. Now it is invasive. Do you feel that it is making inroads into places that it shouldn't be?
I think the first question you asked me is how do we instruct or guide children? And I think as a parent, it's about having the platform to have the conversation. So I think as parents, we need to skill ourselves up and know what it is our children are engaging with, the social media that they're using, the skills and the things that they're developing, so we can have that conversation. And I think once you start having that conversation and laying the rules and the ground rules down, then it's a bit like any other behaviour. You explain to your children really clearly what you expect from them, how you'd like them to behave, and what the kind of sanctions and consequences of breaching that are going to be. And so in that respect, I see the use of technology and the use of media like any other aspect of childhood that just needs to be managed. And parents are skilled and they're able to do that. Is it invasive? I think it's ever present, and I think it has the potential to become absolutely part of everyday family life. But then I think that's about, as a parent, about how you manage it, and again, about how the rules and the parameters that you set down. I think parents need permission to feel like they're in charge. And as a psychologist, I do spend quite a lot of my time saying to parents, you're the adults. The authority lies with you, and you need to feel like you've got permission to say this is how it's going to be and this is how it isn't going to be. And I think that applies to technology as well.
Right. Now, just bear with me just a moment. Hi, are you still there, Elizabeth?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Right. Now, in terms of you saying that it should be omnipresent, do you actually really feel that this sort of family unit, this nuclear unit that we used to have and we used to all be so happy with? That it should be extended to include this sort of open social network of friends that weren't there before. Do you think that is an inevitable consequence of the world that we now live in?
Well, I think you're taking a historical perspective in quite a short frame there, because you're talking about quite a small nuclear family. And I think that if we go back several generations, actually it was about networks in the community and kind of over the garden fence and a much wider, broader social sense of community. And that connectedness tended to be in real life, in person, meeting up with people. But actually there was quite a broad sense of community, and children were raised by a street or a village. So I think it's only in more recent times that it has been more of a kind of tight nuclear sense of family. And I think that children have a great capacity to connect, and that's what they're doing and using the technology that's available to them. I am not overly concerned about that as a psychologist. I think it is problematic if it raises issues for families and they need to be able to deal with it. But in its own right, no, because I think children are going to seek out that connection with others in whichever way it can be achieved.
Okay, I mean, what's interesting, I spoke recently to some psychologists in America, and they were saying, and in fact, some people in I think it used to be called the Tavistock Clinic, where they were saying, and I'm sure that, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that one issue, particularly with things like social media, etc., was that there was a tendency for children to want to big up or make things seem more attractive or more compelling, and that therefore on social media, apparently a practice had started of children photoshopping photographs of things that they'd done. But you would say, well, in that case, then that's a question of managing this.
Absolutely. I think that I'm absolutely concerned about the welfare of children and anything that puts them in this position where they're under pressure or they're experiencing anxiety. I mean, what you're talking about is classic adolescent angst in terms of, am I the same as others? Am I keeping up? How do I compare? I mean, that's the kind of essence of the adolescent condition. And they are expressing that, or that is being displayed by the way that they're engaging with social media. But I would argue that that angst or that difficulty exists already. The social media is becoming a platform for that, and absolutely that has to be managed. Children need to be free from that pressure to compete with others, and absolutely I don't want them experiencing distress or feeling less than, and that's what this kind of comparison taps into. But I would say, as a psychologist, children need to be able to talk about it, they need to be able to get reassurance and support from adults, and they need to be able to have that conversation and understand that social media exists, but that they can manage their relationship with it and that adults can help them manage that relationship.
Okay. And now, obviously, I know that I was unceremoniously cut off by my oldest son's Facebook page. I'm not sure whether I've yet been instituted. One of the companies that we had on earlier, one of the people who we were talking to, said that they'd come up with a technology that allowed parents to monitor their children's Facebook pages to perhaps, you know, be in a position to be able to help with that angst. Is that a good idea? Is that part of that management structure that you're suggesting? Or is that perhaps a parent exceeding the bounds of correct behaviour?
I think that's a really difficult question. I think that to be able to encourage your children to have an open and honest communication and dialogue with you and to feel that they can trust and communicate with you about their worries, then I think you need to have a platform and openness. So if you're doing something with your child or adolescent that is in some way not transparent to them or behind their back, I think it's then quite hard to justify how you follow up with them. I'm concerned about X, Y, Z if you found that out via another means. So my position would be that it is possible to have these conversations with your children in quite a transparent way, and that's definitely the route that I would be encouraging families to go down.
Okay. Just as a final question, one of the other issues that has been raised, and again it was raised by psychologists in the US, is that social media is decreasing attention spans. So people have been complaining about decreases in attention spans for I think as long as I can remember. Is that something that you think that people should be worried about, or is it just that we can, you know, we have always had an attention span that is distracted by something that we find more compelling?
Again, I think it's a very real issue. People see attention span as being a positive attribute, so if you were concerned that was in some way deteriorating, then that would be a worry. It's actually quite notoriously difficult to measure attention span, and as you say, it's developmentally adjustable, so what's normal for a 5-year-old is not the same as for a 15-year-old. What you want is for children to be able to engage and to connect with something and to channel their attention when they need to do so. And we live in a very multi-sensory, interactive, engaging world where children use technology. And so the way they engage with that would, you know, it's not the same as sitting down reading a book. It's much more visual and it works at a much faster pace. Certainly, I think, you know, if it's impacting on children's education and well-being, then I'm concerned about it. But certainly in my clinic setting and in the cases that I work with, that is not an issue that's not a connection that I'm naturally making that children's increased use of technology is impacting on their attention.
Wonderful. Elizabeth Kilby, thank you very, very much. I'm sure that we pitched you into a conversation about social media. I was aiming to have an interview on about this Pocket Money app, but unfortunately my unfamiliarity with some new technology has meant that I couldn't actually switch that call in at the right moment. But I hope that we can get you back on to the programme a little later to talk about the thing that we'd told you that you would be talking about.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers now. Bye-bye.
Right, now, hopefully, we're going to be speaking to Irby Basu. She's the mother of a 13-year-old son. And Irby has some concerns about social media generally. We didn't intend this to be a sort of a social media programme, but I suppose Irby does fit in quite neatly into the points that Elizabeth Kilby was making. Irby, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Irby, what are the concerns that you have in terms of social media?
It's very difficult to define it. It's not just social media. It's just the whole concept of, you know, letting my son have access, or rather letting other people having access to my son and him not being able to protect himself from certain dangers that we all hear about. Too much exposure to what he's watching, what he's reading, and who is he meeting. So it's just a way of, I guess, you know, we don't know what parental controls are available. And as a mother, I'm a bit worried about, you know, not letting him go free and enjoy life as he should be, or, you know, and also protecting him. There is just that dilemma.
So this is, in a sense, it's going back to the point that Elizabeth Kilby was making, and that we need, as parents, because I have four children, we need to be able to manage these situations, and you feel that you are actually not in a position to be able to manage them. Is that right?
That's correct. And especially my fears were slightly heightened when a few years ago I learned that he had a friend who was having a Facebook account, but, you know, slightly exaggerating his age. And you just wonder, you know, what is happening. If a child can exaggerate his age and, you know, get onto Facebook, who else is being able to do that? Who are the sort of people who would have access to your children? So that's the sort of worry I have.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? Because in our normal, real-world lives, we could say to somebody, don't go to that particular place, and we would know if they had. Whereas on the internet, then people can really go wherever they want to, and then they can turn around and say, well, it doesn't actually really matter, does it? Because it's not real.
Yes, but then it can become real. I mean, he is taught a bit about cybersecurity in school. They have been taught for a long time, you know, not to give your address, not to exchange phone numbers and things like that. But, of course, you know, we sometimes falter. However much you tell us, don't do this, don't go there, we would all do that. And you, as a parent, you feel, well, will my child be able to judge? And what protections are there for such things?
So is it, Irby, that you would like to find some place, some source of information that would give you guidance on what you can do and how to restrain this? I mean, earlier we have pulled down.
Yes, that would be very, very useful, yes.
Right. Now, earlier we had pulled down on from Spectrosoft, so and he was saying that they had developed a technology which allowed parents to actually see what was happening on a their child's Facebook accounts. Is that something you think would be a good idea?
To do with for, you know, long term, my son might feel terrible, you know, the big woman is watching me sort of feeling he would have. But initially, I think it's a good idea, definitely.
Right. So what you seem to be indicating as a parent is that you would like to know where you can get more control, and you'd like to know where you could get more information or more tools on how to deal with this. From my perspective as a parent, one of the things that I actually find, I suppose, is that I actually get a bit jealous. I get a bit jealous of the amount of time that my children are spending on these various different networks. And I also feel that the relationships that they have with their friends and with the people from school are in some way strangely starting to invade the home. Is that a feeling that you get, or is
absolutely just to give you an example, Peter, my son is now on Christmas vacation, and I have had a feeling since yesterday, getting up in the morning, coming back home after work, today getting up in the morning, that I have had a perpetual party in my house. Nobody has come to the house, but they are on Skype constantly. and you can hear the laughters, and even if I don't want certain things, even if I don't, you know, want my house, I wouldn't want to use the word invade, but even if I don't want that atmosphere in my house, I don't really have a control. Previously, when my son was younger, you know, when they hadn't discovered Skype, he would ask me, Mom, can I have a play day? But now he doesn't need to ask me. They're just on it, on Skype. And yes, I do get jealous. I never had this opportunity to spend so much time with my friends and at this quality. But, well, there you go. I feel happy, and at the same time, I feel slightly sad for myself that, exactly as you say, that it is coming into my life very much, and I have actually no control over it.
And arguably, too, well, one of the other points about this is that it's not the same as having that party in your house, is it? Because, if you did have that number of people in your house, you would say, no, you can't have that many. You can only have two or, three, or one or two friends around at a time. And two, even though there is this electronic discourse going on, that they're not actually doing those sorts of games and those other things that they would naturally do
but they're doing other kinds of games. They are playing something called Minecraft, and he has a tablet where his friends are on Skype, and there is a desktop where they're playing Minecraft. Everybody is switched onto their own Minecraft and they're playing. So yes, they are playing, they're having games, but very different kind.
Right, but I'm again, you seem to be really verbalising something that I think so many parents are feeling, which is that there is this new world. It's a new world that they don't know very much about, and it's a new world that they don't actually have very, very much control over, or they don't know where to go to get those controls.
Absolutely.
Ubi, I tell you what we'll do. If you email us, I will go and get all of that information for you. I will, and we will have another program where we will put together as much information as we possibly can for all of the parents who feel that they would like to know just a little bit more about this world, and they'd like to know a little bit more about what they should do with this world, how they should interact with it, and what tools they can get to perhaps help in that.
That would be so useful. Thank you very much.
And we can also sort of come up with the tools as well that will prevent you from your children calling you Big Mother and me Big Daddy.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Right, now, hopefully, I should be speaking to Alexei Andrianchenko. I hope I pronounced that properly. Are you there, Alexei?
Yes, hi, I'm here, and it's pretty good. It's a difficult one to say.
It was. I did practice beforehand, but Alexei, you represent a company called Shopitize. We were aiming to get Shopitize to dovetail into something else that we were talking about. Can you let me just tell us what Shopitize is?
Yeah, Shopitize is a free app which you can download on the either iPhone devices or Android devices, and it's quite simply saves you money on brands and products you love and buy in supermarkets. The new thing that it all happens on your mobile, so all you need to do is to go buy the products which are on promotion, snap it the receipt with the app, and you get your cash back either into PayPal or as a check, or we are working now on a way where we directly deposit the savings into your account. So it's that simple. Shop, snap, and save.
Right. So if you could give me an example, I think that would be a very good way of finding out what it is. What would happen? I want to buy a Coke, for example.
Yes, let's say, for example, you download the app and you find that we have an amazing offer on the Kellogg's Crunchy Nut cornflakes, and it is available across different supermarkets. So you'll check which supermarket is closest to you where you can buy it, and you go and just as we normally would, purchase this product and come back home, and with our free app, scan the barcode to make sure that you got the right product, and then take a picture of the receipt on which you have the you purchase product. We, on our system, recognize, analyze this receipt, recognize the product, and reward you with a £1 or offer £1.50 off, depending what the offer is, and then you can transfer this money either into your PayPal account or into your bank account.
Oh, right. So it's not the same as my having one of the paper coupons that I give in and say, hey, I collected this from a magazine, it gives me a pound off.
Yeah, absolutely. There is no paper involved, so you do not need to look for the coupons. You don't need to cut them out, to put them in your purse, or in your wallet, making sure that you have it when you go shopping. You can actually be in the shop, check what offers are available, get the product, buy it, and then get the cash back.
Right.
So no paper involved at all. We try to make it as easy for the consumer as possible.
Now, I mean, obviously the idea of offers is to get somebody to try a product and then maybe to prefer it to another product. So it's a marketing exercise. What is, I understand this has been going down very, very well with the shops and the retailers. Why is that?
There are different reasons why companies and brands choose to use promotions. In certain cases, it is, to incentivize purchases during a particular period of time. Like we see a lot of offers happening at Christmas. There is sometimes it's just to try new products and introduce new flavor. So the reasons behind for that can be quite a few. I think what Shopify allows brands to do is to interact with the consumers directly. Because mobile is a device that connects them, with the people who actually consume and buy their products, rather than going through the retailer directly. But there are advantages for retailers and supermarkets here as well, because it takes quite a significant amount of time and effort and cost for supermarkets to process paper coupons or some this type of discounts at the checkout. But in this particular case, the shoppers themselves do this by snapping the receipt. So it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Right. Now, it's interesting that you point out that the people want to have this direct engagement with people via their mobile phones. Why is that?
Because for brands that you normally buy through supermarkets, these companies rarely have a chance to interact with you directly as a shopper. Because you have the relationship most of the time with the supermarket. And so the supermarkets know quite a lot about you, especially if you use, for example, your loyalty cards with a particular retailer. However, brands have to rely on the secondary information about understanding you as an individual shopper. Well, in this particular case, because brands give offers directly to their shoppers, to their consumers through the mobile, they can also understand who the shoppers are, how they like to shop, what products they prefer, and therefore tailor offers in the best possible way. So it is understanding your end consumer. I think that what brings most value to the brands who work with us.
So in a sense, we're in this very, very, this is an expression of this strange new world that we're moving in, where it seems to be that everybody wants to know us and everybody wants to know things about us.
Yeah, I think this is inevitable, because we are, the pace of life, catches up so fast that we expect things, to be kind of pre-selected for us. Curated, if you want to. We want to have choice, but we want also to be it for the relevant products, for the relevant offers. And therefore, I think you're absolutely right. There is a trend in trying to anticipate and understand what each one of us would like to receive, would like to purchase. But we take this process very seriously. And for us, it's more important to understand how you shop, rather than who you are and what your name and where you live. As long as we can deliver, the best possible value to you, I think that then all parties are happy.
When you say how you shop, does that mean that you're looking for patterns in the way that people are shopping? Or what did you mean by that?
Yes, I think what we're trying to understand is if you as a shopper are never buy meat because you're a vegetarian, that would be, you know, quite a waste of time and resources and your attention if we continue if we try to send you an offer for meat products. Therefore, knowing how you shop, what you shop for, is help us to make sure that the offers and the promotions that we deliver to you are very relevant. What we want to try to go away from is when you are bombarded with all offers which might or might not be relevant to you, is understanding, you know, your shopping patterns and delivering the value to what you would like to have. This is what we're trying to achieve.
Right. Okay. Well, Alexei, thank you very, very, very much for coming onto the programme. I mean, obviously, this is it's not Green Shield stamps. It's nothing like that. This is an insight that companies now want to get into each one of us as an individual. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think we are entering the world of mass personalization. When we want to be recognized that we're shopping in different way, in individual way, and that we expect brands and companies to service our needs and desires based on this information. So I think, yes, it's a new trend where we want to be recognized for the individuals we are and to be, you know, treated individually. I think we've accepted that in the online world when our search results or when our, you know, the way what we look at is analyzed and we get a much better experience based on those insights. What we want to do in Shopitize is to bring some of that into the real world and therefore make things more relevant to you and therefore more beneficial.
And I suppose, Alex, if people don't want to participate in this exercise, if they don't want to be down like this, then they just won't download the app. They won't take advantage of it.
Yes, I think that would be the case, but I would see very little reason why somebody would want to do it, because in our system, you control what information that you upload to the system. So if you want to get, you know, a discount for Christmas turkey or, you know, Bailey's during the Christmas, and you scan a receipt that has those products and you're getting money, but it's in exactly the same way as you reporting your information when you shop at the supermarket. In this particular case, you have a full control of what information you submit. We have very clear policy on how we use it, and we use this information to be able to drive value back to you.
Just one last question then. If I wanted to opt out of this system, what? You would delete all of my information, would you?
Yes, if you request to delete your account, we will simply delete your account and you will not be contacted, and therefore there will be no trace. No trace of that.
But would that delete my history?
Yes, we will delete the history as well. But what I want to stress is when you register with the only information we ask from you is the email. So we, in case there is any complication in the process of your redemption, that we can contact you on this. We do not ask your name, not ask. So it is this information is anonymized already. However, if you feel very strong that this is even anonymized information, you want to delete this, we certainly will follow up the procedure and we'll delete the information.
I mean, you've obviously developed a policy on this, haven't you? Did you think that there is a growing sensitivity or growing awareness by people of the fact that their information is being collected and used?
I think we sometimes not often realize where the information is collected and where it's being used. So I think what we try to do is to be very explicit of what the information is collected and why and for what purpose it is used. Because when we use club cards in stores, loyalty cards, the information needs to get collected on us and it's being stored and it's being analyzed, and therefore the coupons that you receive from the retailers is in a way informed by this information. When you use the Oyster card, so we leave digital trace everywhere we go, in a sense. At Shopitize, we are very open about that we need this information to process your order. We do not ask for more than is required to return value back to you. And in this particular case, You also control what information you want to submit. So we cannot grab more data and we wouldn't want to, and there is no reason for us, than what you supply to us voluntarily on your terms.
Wonderful. Alexei, I'm now going to have another go at your name and see if I can get even better at it. That was Alexei Andrianenko of Shopitize, co-founder of Shopitize. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Right, now, hopefully, we're going to be going to Paul Cocker. Paul Cocker is an expert on encryption. Obviously, the whole part and point of this programme has been to let you know how much data there is about you out there and the places that it could end up. Now, if you do want to opt out of all of this, then one of the things that you should think about doing is basically encrypting that data, protecting your own data, working out what information is of value to you and what you should do with it. That is both from a commercial point of view, if you're a business, or from an individual point of view. And the whole point of encryption is something that we haven't really, really thought about. There was a time when you mentioned the word encryption and people would quite simply look a little dazed. But anyway, have an happy Christmas with... this is Radio Castle's new technology show. And basically, we would like to wish you all a very, very, very happy Christmas and a happy new year.